The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Hi, this is Kevin McCullough. Thanks for listening to the Christian Outlook podcast, where we cover today's issues from a perspective that honors your Christian faith. Our podcast is brought to you through a partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. Here's another piece I trust you'll enjoy.
As promised, Abigail Schreier is my guest. She's written an important book, folks. It is called Irreversible Damage: The Transgender Craze Seducing Our Daughters. Abigail, welcome to this program.
Thanks so much for having me on.
This is really important. The book is brand new. It's called Irreversible Damage. I know that you're a writer, frequent contributor to the Wall Street Journal. This is, it strikes me, one of the central issues of our time, the madness that has overtaken our culture with regard to this issue. So where are you coming from and how did you find your way to writing about this issue?
So this was not an issue that I sought out. I had written a piece for the Wall Street Journal on transgender pronoun laws. We have laws in two states now, New York and California, that actually assign criminal penalties for misgendering someone, using something other than their preferred gender pronouns. And this is just straightforwardly unconstitutional. In America, the government cannot compel people to say anything. And so that's what I wrote in the Wall Street Journal. It's actually constitutionally fairly uncontroversial. We've long known that you can't make people say things in America, or the government can't make people say things. And a reader read this and wrote to me and said, would you be willing to take this on? Would my daughter, you know, has been caught up in this sudden trans identification. All kinds of girls are all across our country. And in fact, it turns out across the West. And she asked me to look into it. And I said, I wrote her back. I said, I'm an opinion journalist, not an investigative journalist. So I found someone else for her. And I waited for many months and no article came. And that's when I decided to give it another look and take it up.
Well, look, most people who are half paying attention know that this is a kind of madness. It's part of a larger madness that seems to have been attacking the West over some time, I would say. But it seems to have come to a head in a number of ways. One of them is this idea that our genders are somehow fluid or whatever. I mean, maybe let's start here. Where did what most people, whether they're willing to say it or aren't, what most people know to be a crazy idea, where did this come from? Even though, you know, people like me understand that it's it doesn't seem to have any basis in reality, but how has it been thrust upon us so quickly and so overwhelmingly? That's not clear to me.
So a couple ways. So the transgender activists, by which I do not mean transgender people who are, you know, lovely. I've interviewed many of them for my book. But the activists who are the most extreme members of any group have been very, very successful at pushing a gender ideology. Both in the universities have taught this for years in various courses, and into the schools. One of the problems is that there, and I learned this when I did my investigation into the public school system in California, there's no difference between activists and teachers in the California school system. So that the activists come in and are teaching teachers. They're instructing them. They're providing curricula for gender ideology and sexual orientation instruction. They're doing this under the guise of anti-bullying. And they have enabled a full-scale curriculum, kindergarten through all the way through 12th in California. And then the activists have been very aggressive in the medical association. So the professional associations now all have adopted affirmative care as the standard, meaning that when a transgender-identified person comes to them and says, self-diagnosis with gender dysphoria, the role of the mental health professional and even the physician is to agree with the patient's self-diagnosis. There's no other area of medicine that requires this.
Well, look, we used to say that homosexual attraction was a psychiatric problem. It seems to me that the psychiatric establishment hasn't been willing to do anything but fold to pressure. In other words, you've got to be able to make a reasonable case for why what we would call gender dysphoria isn't a kind of madness, that it isn't a kind of a problem. Suddenly to fold and to say, you know what, we got it all wrong, sorry, and how can we help you? I mean, I don't understand. I'm coming from a biblical perspective, right? I believe that, you know, what the West has taught and what the Judeo-Christian scriptures have represented for now millennia is true. And I think most people around the world would say something similar. How does it happen that educated people in the West on a dime turn around and say, that's all wrong, and we now have information evidently to support the idea that everybody got it wrong forever until this minute?
Well, let me push back on you a little bit about something, and that is that I've interviewed a lot of transgender adults for my book, and I have to say that very many of them are leading good, productive lives in which being transgender does not seem an impediment to a full and healthy life.
And excuse me, let me just be clear in what I said. I didn't mean to suggest anything different from what you just said. I'm talking about the larger perspective. How has that changed?
I understand. Yeah. So, but then you have this activist population, right? So you have an activist population, which is, you know, by definition, very extreme. Some of whom I don't even know if what they're suffering from is exactly gender dysphoria, right? You have a very aggressive population of people trying to push into women's bathrooms, trying to make women uncomfortable. These are not at all like the, you know, so many of the rational and normal and healthy transgender adults I've interviewed. And in fact, they're very alienated by these people. Very often transgender adults just want to pass in society. And they're also not like the young girls. These teenage girls, we have a 100-year history, diagnostic history of gender dysphoria now. We know what it looks like. And what these teenage girls claim to have is not gender dysphoria. It doesn't match up with gender, what we know about gender dysphoria. So it really is a contemporary hysteria through the schools of girls self-diagnosing with this. And unfortunately, we've put all these categories of people under the same, you know, in the same bag and surrounded them with civil rights and the idea that this is a brave new thing. But in actuality, I think it's several different phenomena going on at once. And with the young girls specifically, what they're suffering with does not seem to be gender dysphoria per se.
Okay, this is why it's so difficult, right? You've just said it. I mean, people try to make sense of this, and you're talking about several things at once. And I think that, you know, what I've seen here in Manhattan, in New York, where I live, that it becomes a thing, right? In certain circles, it's the thing that so-and-so in my class has decided, you know, that she's a boy. So-and-so, that it's suddenly, it's in the drinking water, as it were. And that's what you talk about in your book, that suddenly now you have all these young women, I guess, responding to various social pressures. And you're saying that's genuinely different than somebody who really is sincerely struggling and trying to figure this out. This is more of a trendy thing that has kind of captured the minds of young people.
Well, I do think these girls are genuinely suffering. So I definitely would say these girls are in severe distress. But very often, as with, you know, hysterias of the past, you know, multiple personality dysphoria, even anorexia and bulimia, girls have been able to spread this, which doesn't mean they're not in distress. They're in serious distress. They have very high rates of anxiety and depression. They're in pain. But when they look to describe that pain, sometimes they look to things that are in the culture, and they've latched onto this, even, and the reason we know, by the way, this isn't traditional gender dysphoria is these girls have no childhood history. Gender dysphoria has always begun in early childhood, and it overwhelmingly afflicted males. So in the 100-year history of gender dysphoria, we've never seen it start in adolescence and be overwhelmingly female. And yet now they are the dominant demographic all over the West. Girls, between 2016 and 2017, the number of gender surgeries for natal females quadrupled in the United States. So we know that this population that has never, this demographic that has never before experienced gender dysphoria and has experienced something that really doesn't look like exactly like gender dysphoria is experiencing it in the highest numbers. And it's the same demographic that falls prey to a lot of social contagions.
I was going to say that's right. In other words, it seems to me that, you know, when you hear about girls cutting themselves or you hear about a number of things along those lines. So there's real pain, but it finds a channel in this trend. Everybody's doing this or doing this, and now it's this, but the title of your book is Irreversible Damage. This, it's not something like bulimia or anorexia, which is reversible. It's a different kind of problem. How did it happen that this became a way that young women are dealing with you know, the kind of pain that seems to come along with much of adolescence?
So there are a couple of reasons this happened. First, these young girls are in severe distress. So this generation of girls, we know they have extraordinarily high rates of anxiety and depression like we've never seen before. And several researchers now have tied it very precisely to the introduction in 2007 of the iPhone and with social media. We know that social media causes us to compare ourselves to other people, and that causes everyone, you know, some measure of anxiety and feeling bad. And we know that adolescent girls suffer the most from this. So we know we've got this distressed population. At the same time, we also have the thorough gender ideology indoctrination in the schools. So it's constantly being suggested to them that they might not be their gender. Okay, this is constantly presented as an option to them. We also see it that the transgender status has been raised in the culture, which, you know, some may say is a good thing, that they're no longer treated as poorly by the society as they once were. But there's been a rise in status of transgender people. At the same time, you've seen a diminution in status of girls and women. And you see that when you have, you know, biological boys out competing them on sports teams, taking their trophies. You know, you see that in mediocre biological boys, I should say, mediocre athletes taking their trophies, men pushing their way into their locker rooms. It's no secret that the culture has really turned its back on girls. And so you add all that together to the fact that, you know, adolescence has always been a hard time for girls. Your body is changing, your hormones are raging, and it's by its very nature a very vulnerable and difficult time. And now you're constantly telling them they could choose something else. And the last thing I should add, by the way, this is a time when victim status is something very sought after by our youth. And this is the only victim status that a young white girl can choose. And so many of them do.
It seems to me, you know, that this is a failure of moral courage. In other words, that there are plenty of people who know something's wrong, but they know that there's a cost to speaking up. They know that they will be on the outs if they come against some of the ideology that's being pushed. And, you know, when I hear you talk about this being pushed in schools, I think it's a very fair question to say, is it any business of government schools to be pushing this kind of ideology? Why are they doing this? I mean, this is no different to me than if they were teaching a particular religious faith in the schools. It's not their role to do that. That's something that ought to be done at home, that parents have control over, but they really have pushed their way in.
They have, and actually my chapter on the schools is one of my favorite chapters because I was able to sort of go deep and really, I hope, unearth what was actually going on in California, and which is a model for public schools across the country. You know, there really, I can only say that there was no difference between when I looked at the people and the materials they were using. It turned out there was no difference between the teachers and the activists. Very often the teachers were members of activist organizations. The Gay Straight Alliance Club, which is set up to be a haven for gay students, in fact, was very often just an avenue for pushing gender ideology. So I think that there was a lot of, I don't know what to call it, but bad faith in our school system, whereas rather than educating these children, they decided to remake them.
You said it perfectly. I mean, that's exactly right. Even the idea that someone can remake kids or people is itself an ideology. It argues against that we have an innate nature, which itself is like a religious, belief. And if you're pushing that on kids, you need to be called out on it and to say that, you know, you can have those beliefs, but to push them on our kids is another thing. That's not the role of the schools. You said bad faith. I mean, that's being generous, because I think it is the camel's nose in the tent, right? In other words, you say you're a victim. You say people are being discriminated against. And all good Americans say, well, we don't want that. Even if I disagree with this or that, nobody should be persecuted. And so we go along with it. And then the next thing we know, they've gained a power base and they're using it in ways that they never advertised. I mean, it seems to me that this is particularly true in public education. What do you think it is about teachers' unions that makes them so amenable to this? It's a strange development in our history.
It is a strange development. And I think what you said is the reason that it's hit progressive families so hard. The vast majority of the parents I talk to and are politically progressive, and they didn't do anything wrong. They were just, when they were told that their schools were introducing, teaching about a transgender child or teaching about gender options to their kids, they really thought, well, if this is what's necessary to prevent bullying, then I certainly don't want anyone bullied. And if teaching kids about pride, having a pride parade at school, they were more likely to think, well, that's a very nice thing. And unfortunately, these parents also got very abused, because what seemed, or was presented as an anti-bullying measure was really about indoctrinating their children and sowing gender confusion in the students. The majority of the parents I talk to are politically progressive who have suffered with this. And part of, they didn't do anything wrong. I think they approached the school system with good faith, and they believed, many of them believed that, and also the private school system, they very often had their kids in secular private school or in public school. And they believed that if teaching about gender ideology was, or teaching about different sexualities and genders was necessary to prevent bullying, they were much more willing to go along with it. And I think they did that really from a place of compassion and real sincerity. And I think they were very abused by ideologues who took advantage and used it as an opportunity to indoctrinate their children and sow gender confusion.
I mean, that seems to me at the heart of the American problem, right? We're an extremely tolerant people. We really want everybody to get along, and that we've always been that way, but there's a downside to it, right? In other words, that works until someone decides to take advantage of it. And it seems to me that we see this over and over and over again, that people understand that if they can play the victim Trump card, they will have power. And we've seen that over and over and over again, that they're willing to use our, native cultural tendency toward tolerance to gain more power for themselves. And then I would say another part of the American problem that's endemic is that we don't know exactly what we believe a lot of the time. We kind of go along half believing things. And so we don't have the cultural confidence to stand up and to say, excuse me, no, that's wrong. We're paying our taxes so that you can teach our kids in loco parentis. You do not have our permission to impose these ideologies on our kids. That's not what we're paying you for. It's not why we've ever had public schools. But people really have just been too busy to think about it and to push back. And so we sort of find ourselves here.
Right. So a lot of the parents, the thing to know about this is very often the distress and the identification and that these girls announce is not really about gender dysphoria at all. And one of the sort of interesting facets of this is that very often these girls would come to their progressive parents and say at 13, having never kissed a boy or a girl, had any romantic experience, because these girls tend to be very sheltered, very bright, very sheltered. They would say, I'm a lesbian. And the parents would react with total embrace. They would embrace the kid and say, oh, are you a lesbian? That's great. You know, that whatever you want to be, let me, drive you to prom with your girlfriend and whatnot. And then very often the girl would dial it, take it up a notch and say, oh yeah, well now I'm trans. And it turned out what the girl sometimes was asking for was not recognition of her genuine sexual identity. What she was asking for was rebellion. And when the parents were so sort of willing to go along with an announcement of a sexual orientation, even from a child who was 12 years old and had no experience, romantic or otherwise, when the parents embraced it, it would turn out that the child would be pushing for more and more, because what they really wanted more than anything was individuation from the parents. So they land on, oh yeah, mom, well, you know, I'm so different from you. I'm a boy. And then, wow. Yeah, and that's sort of where it breaks down.
Well, there's so much here. It's interesting because you feel like the role of the parent is to push back, right? Not to go along, but to say, excuse me, go to your room. In other words, that in a funny way, that's what kids are craving. And so they push and push and push until they meet that. And if they don't meet that, they keep going. And in a funny way, I would say also part of the, from the 60s onward, we've denigrated, ancient ideas of older people being wiser. And we basically said, the youth are wiser. And so parents don't want to be perceived as parents. They want to be friends. And that leads to all kinds of problems because that's not your job. Your job is to be a parent, not a friend. Friendship is a great thing if you can get it, but first you have to be a parent. So if you're unwilling to be unpopular with your own kids, you sort of help the spiral. At least that's how I'm processing what you're saying.
That's right. So I'm part of Gen X. I'm sort of the end of Gen X. And one of the things about Gen X parents is that we really didn't want to be like our parents. We wanted to be more psychologically attuned and more open and embracing and really be friends in certain sense with our kids. And the problem with that is that when a 12 or 13 year old thinks that decides they're a lesbian. And another thing is that we tend to micromanage, right? We're the helicopter generation of parents. So when a 12 or 13 year old girl who has never had any romantic or sexual experience announces she's lesbian, very often parents in my generation thinks there's something for them to do. They have to go to social media and make a public announcement or, take their daughter to pride parades. What I think is important to remember sometimes is that the kid is still just 12 or 13. And there's no need to do anything about that. It's not a project. Sometimes it's just a fleeting feeling, and it's a feeling that may evolve or change over time. And it's okay for the kid to just sit with that without making any public pronouncements or any irreversible decisions.
Well, it's funny. I know that you have Yale in your background, and I remember when I was there, a friend had a younger sister, classic Manhattan elite kind of upbringing. And suddenly she was a lesbian and she, was traveling in those circles. And lo and behold, 10 years later, she married a guy and that was all forgotten. And I thought to myself, that makes perfect sense based on my perception of it, that it was this kind of a thing. It was a trendy thing at the time. It was accepted. And then it just went away. It's the most bizarre thing. And so if someone had done something about it and made it irreversible, the way we're talking about, it's the title of your book, Irreversible Damage, that would have been horrific. And so what is irreversible about the damage that's being done? What do you mean by that?
Okay, well, on a lower, on a smaller level, a public announcement of a transgender identity on social media starts to solidify that for a young person. Okay. So there, at that point, a young person very often feels like she can't take it back, even if she no longer feels the same way. But the irreversible damage that I'm talking about in the book is even more, is even scarier. And that is that when you introduce testosterone to a woman's body at 10 to 40 times, which you would normally have, you're creating a lifetime patient. She must stay on them for the rest of her life unless she wants to, because she'll lose some of the effects if she doesn't. She will very often end with infertility. She will have body and facial hair. She will have alterations to her private anatomy, and it will deepen her voice. Then if she goes on, there are, of course, all sorts of surgeries that are very often rushed to by this population of girls in distress, like top surgery. Top surgery is a voluntary double mastectomy that destroys biological capacity, both erogenous and obviously lactation.
Thank you for interrupting, but you mean to tell me that this is happening with teenagers, that there are doctors willing to do this kind of surgery?
Yes, absolutely. I profile some of them in my book. A 16-year-old, I mean, depending where they live, right? The age of medical consent varies by state. But depending where you live, and some under 18 require parental approval, some do not. So without even a therapist's note, a young girl can self-diagnose with gender dysphoria, show up at a surgeon's office who's willing to perform it, and have both her breasts removed.
What kind of surgeons are these, Abigail? It strikes me that they are very, very selfish surgeons if they're willing to make money off of this.
Well, they're being told a lie, right? They're being told that if they don't do this to appease the girl, the girl will kill herself. So,
right. But you know, and I know that it's a lie. And even if it ends up being true, it's still a lie because it's being used to manipulate people.
It is, but it's successfully manipulated even the professional organizations. Some of these doctors are following the guidelines set out by their own professions. So the problem is even deeper than an individual doctor. It's really, I mean, this is a systemic problem. I know the word systemic is used a lot, but it really is a systemic problem.
You know, I hate to take this to the Nazis, but having written a book on the Third Reich, it just sounds so dramatically similar to me that what was happening in the professions in Germany in the 30s with a National Socialist agenda, that it affected the professions, and there were people in those professions who lacked the courage to stand up. And it's we just got seconds left. I always hate, of course, to bring it back to the Third Reich, but if people in the professions are not willing to stand up and to know what they believe or to say, I'm not going to go along with this quite yet because we don't have the data, that's all you need. And to think that that's happening in America right now, it's just horrifying. It's to me.
I can only tell you that I wrote this book in part because I was getting so many calls from doctors who were saying that they couldn't express their medical judgment within their professional expertise without fear of being fired. And I realized that if journalists didn't write about this, no one would.
It's amazing. Well, first of all, thank you. But I mean, there are worse things than losing one's job. You know, the idea that people will do horrific damage to someone to keep their job. I just want to say that we need more than folks like you writing these books. Maybe it will put some backbone in some of these professionals because there are children whose futures depend on this. That's the point of your book. We're out of time. Abigail Schreier, thank you for
thank
your
you.
Voice. Thank you for the book, Irreversible Damage. I hope people will grab a copy. Thanks again.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for listening to Christian Outlook. Our program is coming to you today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership programs offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. If you enjoy our podcast, take a moment and tell a friend to subscribe today.